Today's guest has a view of grief and the grieving process that is accentuated with her own personal experiences. She is with us today to shed some light on an often insufficiently discussed or understood fact of life, and that is the fact of loss. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk, and pleased to introduce to you Candace Osfort Russell, who is a grief advocate and counselor. Candace, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Candace, your journey to becoming a grief therapist started when you lost your husband. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience?
Sure. I was in career transition when I had my son and decided to stay home with him. And my husband was in full support of that. And then 9 months into my child's life, when he was 9.5 months old, my husband became suddenly ill. He was a runner. He was healthy. He was young. But he suddenly became ill, went into the hospital on New Year's Day, right after Christmas, and died the day after Valentine's Day. He had a virus that attacked his heart, and he was only sick for 6 weeks, and then he died. And so I was suddenly widowed and alone, raising this 11-month-old child. And needless to say, it was devastating. And I got lots of messages in our culture as a young mother trying to take care of a son, that I should quickly get over things, you know, get back to normal as fast as possible. You should just take a year to get over this, and get over it was a big message. But luckily my family was very supportive, and I had the means to go to a really good therapist who walked all the way through this process with me. It was years long, but I was continuing to function. I don't want to make it sound like I wasn't functional. I was completely functional. I was determined to be a good mother for my son. And at the same time, I had help to allow this sudden loss to really affect me in the way that it naturally did. I was able to fully grieve and rebuild my whole inner world that got shattered by this sudden trauma. And I came out of that experience in about 5 years with this deep understanding that what I needed to do myself was be a therapist for people who were experiencing trauma and loss, because having seen all those dark places and been helped to go through them, I had a fearlessness about sitting with people in those dark places and a trust in what kinds of things we learn when we go there.
You reference the day that he went into the hospital and
yes.
the day that he died. And,
yes.
you know, so clearly those are days that are just with you. And
yes.
I want for people who have that kind of experience, where the loss
yes.
is forever connected to a particular day that would ordinarily be a celebratory time.
Right.
What do they do?
Well, what my experience is having help to expand to a both and perspective. There's so much stuff in our culture about either or, kind of like that holiday or that day is either celebratory or it's sad. And once the sad part takes over, you have to get over that or put it behind you in order to reclaim the positive aspect of the day. But I really think one of the things that I learned and that has served me so well in life going through this is that our natural capacity is to be able to feel more than one thing at a time. And certainly at first, in the first few years after a difficult loss, the difficulty, the pain, the sadness, and the trauma around a particular day, like for me, New Year's and Valentine's Day, both of those days had, you know, in the first few years, it was dominated by painful memories, sadness, that kind of thing. But over time, it became like my heart started to stretch, where I could actually feel the enormity of I have a child who's growing and excited about the fireworks on New Year's. I feel the excitement with him, and my heart hurts because I remember this pain around the loss of my husband. And what I found, and what I find with the clients that I work with, is when we have help to, it's kind of an intense feeling to feel the both at the same time. But when you have help to feel both of those things at once, an additional enlivened emotion arises, which is feeling moved and grateful that that you have the capacity to feel so alive. And you don't have to shut down to any of those emotions. Does that make sense?
It does. And you know, what's interesting is that so many times people really struggle and judge themselves when they have multiple emotions at one time. Particularly around the issue of grieving and loss. Maybe sad,
yes,
that the person is gone, and angry that the person is gone,
yes,
for example.
Yes. Yes, I think that is, it's actually the norm. I think that's actually part of what our psyche does for us in a healthy way to help us heal, is to feel all of those emotions at once. And what I find in what I like to write about and work with clients about is starting to identify what all the different feelings are, because I think the feelings are hard to bear when they're a blob, when it's just a blob of big feelings and you don't really know what they are. It's just a mixture, and that's overwhelming. But when you can start to kind of untangle the blob into the strands that make it up, like you said, sadness, sometimes anger at the person who died, even anger at the universe that they died, if you're not angry at them. Sometimes you have happy memories of the person you lost. Sometimes you're actually feeling good in the moment and you feel bad about feeling good because you're healing. And if you can kind of start to notice what the different feelings are that make up that kind of big knot of feelings, they become manageable. It's like you can, individual feelings kind of move through like clouds move across the sky. And when you can see, yes, I'm angry, express the anger. I'm also sad. You cry a little bit. You can name each one of the feelings. They just become feelings, which are part of feeling alive, instead of that, like I said, that tangled mass that is unmanageable.
And they become, I would suggest, a lot more normalized. You start to feel a lot less like an oddball, particularly in the face of folks looking at you and telling you that you should feel one thing or the other.
Exactly. And that's one big part of my message, is that it is normal to feel all of those feelings, and it's normal for it to take a long time. And our culture really is a fast-moving culture, and we have a hard time with circumstances that you can't change. We like in this culture to believe we're always in control, and things like death and illness that really shine the light on places where we don't have control, I think actually offer an opportunity for us to grow into a softer, more compassionate way of being in the world. But we need time, and we need patience, and there's these myths in our culture that say you should get over this fast and there's a particular way you ought to do it, and it just doesn't fit with how real humans operate.
Yeah, we don't do well with the idea of being vulnerable.
We don't, and yet there's so many, I hesitate to use the word gift because I am not somebody who would ever tell somebody going through a difficult time, just look at all the gifts you're giving. So I hate that word, but there's a purpose to vulnerability rather than it being a gift. There is a purpose to vulnerability. We are wired to actually kind of grow from being vulnerable. When our kind of fixed ways of viewing the world are challenged, I think that's when a particular place vulnerability can arise, where we notice that things are different than what we'd really believed. And instead of hardening and trying to go back to the way we were, if we can be with the vulnerability, it's actually how we are wired to grow, where a fixed way of being comes apart and rebuilds at a more complex and compassionate level.
Let's talk about the different kinds of loss experiences that people may encounter? Because so many times, as you well know, if someone has lost, if you will, a loved one, a close loved one, then there's, yes, you know, there's a reasonable amount of support for the grieving. But then, yes, if it's a different kind of loss, maybe it's something that in theory one should be happy about, or it's a quote unquote minor loss, then there are, right, different kinds of responses. What are some of the other losses that people routinely experience?
Well, that's a great question. There's a lot of different kinds of losses that, I mean, there's loss in, within the, there's different kinds of losses based on either death or not death also. And in the realm of death, losing a friend can be profoundly affecting, and losing a pet is profoundly affecting. People often feel really ashamed or confused when they have a deep, abiding sense of grief when they've lost an animal, but our connections with our pets are very deep relationships, and it's very normal to grieve the loss of a pet in a deep way. And likewise, relationships like friendships and other kinds of relationships that people don't acknowledge as life-changing. There's also loss due to situations other than death. I mean, one example, there's several examples. There are situations that have ongoing loss associated with them, like if you have a child who is born with disabilities or acquires disabilities, or if adoption is another situation like that. Adoption is a really good example of something that can be both happy and painful, and it fits with a lot of different kinds of loss that we don't acknowledge in our culture very much. Adoption is one of those situations that contains ongoing grief, potentially, not necessarily, but potentially, for all three members of the adoption triad: the person who's given up a baby for adoption, the person who is adopted, and the adoptive parents. Each one of those has an ongoing sense of loss of something that can crop up again and again for a lifetime. But I think that's the thing, that in our culture, we avoid looking at the grief that can go along with that, because somehow if there's ongoing grief, we believe it means there's something wrong with the situation. But I think some situations, and I like the example of adoption, some situations like adoption can be happy also, and really good and appropriate and fitting for everyone involved. It just so happens that grief is part of the ongoing situation. And so it will just punctuate life periodically, but it doesn't mean that anybody did anything wrong. It just is.
It doesn't mean that anybody is sick, if you will, or crazy or disturbed. It just, as you said, it just is.
That's right. That's right. Periodically. And these, the punctuation marks of grief tend to arise around marker times in life, like milestones. For example, like when a person who was adopted as a baby becomes a parent herself, for example. That's a time that she's very likely to feel a lot of grief and confusion and questions around her own adoption, because she's going through the experience of giving birth and having her own baby. And so that's another place where, when we can recognize a both and is possible, it really expands the experience of the person going through it. Like for that mother to be feeling both sorrow and grief, and maybe even anger at her birth mother for giving her up, gratitude to the parents who adopted her, and profound appreciation that she's getting to have this experience and isn't having to give her baby up. So feeling all of those feelings is actually a very enlivened experience.
And, you know, I also think about changes in body image or even a job promotion.
Absolutely.
Those are all things that have so many different layers of feelings attached to them.
That's right. And that's that was another aspect I was going to bring in, that even the positive changes like that, job promotion, getting married, having a baby, buying a house, all those kinds of positive life transitions also involve leaving another kind of life behind. And for us to grieve what we're leaving behind actually creates more space for receiving the fullness of what you are about to, jump into. And so it's actually normal, as you're, even if you're thrilled about getting married and you feel like your new spouse is a really good fit for you and you're excited about it, it's also normal to feel afraid and sad about letting go of the life you had before where you were single and unattached.
So what we're saying, what you're saying, is that it is very human and very normal to have a range of feelings attached to the same experience.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. And that's a very, it's so interesting to me that it seems like the reflex is for us to be afraid of having, like you said, that range of feelings. And when we are able to feel the full range of feelings, it makes the experience itself much more rich and textured and like three-dimensional instead of two-dimensional.
You know, it's interesting, as I think about reflect on your story, and you were saying that it took you several years as you went through your process with your therapist. And I think about, yes, those folks who are working and they have X number of weeks to grieve and then go back to work, and they're supposed to be back at work and doing their thing.
Right.
It's really quite interesting, and it's really kind of extraordinary, the expectations that we sometimes have of ourselves.
It really is. And the other thing that I'd like to say for people who have that situation is, I mean, the thing that I noticed when I was in therapy, and that we can get for ourselves if we don't have the means to go get help from someone, which I can talk about ways we can kind of attend to our own process if we don't have the means to do that. But what I found is that, I had to go back immediately to mothering an infant, and I had to be on, and I had to be ready to take care of him. And I also didn't want him to have the experience of both losing his father and having a mother who shut down. So I really had a sense of being torn in two a lot of times, where I felt overwhelmed by grief and also just drawn by a toddler's energy to be alive and excited about his life and his development. So I had to be on immediately every day, get up and take care of him every day. But what I found is having this place that I knew that I could go to every week that was attending to the feelings of grief helped me function during the rest of the week, where I knew I could go fall apart in my therapist's office, feel all my feelings, be acknowledged for my feelings, where I could just kind of come apart at the seams for that hour. And it actually helped me during the rest of the week go through the week being able to function with the sadness in the, kind of running in the background but not dominating my experience, because my psyche knew that I was going to attend to it at this specific time. That's very different than just gutting it up and not giving yourself a chance to feel.
Absolutely.
The psyche's really smart knowing the difference,
Candace Osford Russell, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue this conversation about the various ways in which we experience grief and how we can, in various ways, begin the process of healing from grief. is another form of loss that many people experience is that of divorce. And
yes.
Whether it's a divorce that you are excited about or heartbroken about, it's still loss.
Yes.
And it's interesting that in our society, so many times, there's just not space, certainly if you're working outside of the home, there's not a whole lot of space to allow you to go through your grief process. What do you say to those who are going through a divorce and how they can manage or negotiate that loss?
Well, I think it's kind of similar to other kinds of loss in that, I mean, it's very specific kind of loss, but as far as being able to process the loss while you have to just keep going about your life. And I think the key is to mindfully give yourself permission to have some spaces of time to attend to your feelings of loss. And I know that that can be very difficult for people who, say, suddenly become single parents due to a divorce, where now all of a sudden they're alone managing a household and a job and children. And so hearing me say take some time for yourself can sound ridiculous, but I'm saying even 5 or 10 minutes at the end of each day, if you can take 5 or 10 minutes to, I mean, a number of things can be helpful. You have to discover what's right for you. There's no one size fits all, but journaling is an excellent way of attending to your feelings. Even if you just do it for 5 or 10 minutes once a day or even once a week. Some people really don't like journaling, though, and so I suggest to people like that to take a walk or do something with movement of the body for 5 or 10 minutes while you attend specifically to the feelings of your loss. It really is interesting to me that it's like a part of us, a deep part of our psyche, of our soul, of our mind, needs to be attended to kind of reorient to the new normal of let's say a marriage that is no longer in existence, or a person who's gone from our lives in some way or another. It really wreaks havoc on the internal organization of our world. And so giving time for attending to the pain, to the kind of ruminating, it's like contemplation, not rumination, contemplation of what this means to my life now, how this reconstructs what I believe to be true about the world. Giving yourself time to attend to that in even small ways really takes some of the pressured feeling off while you are continuing to function in your life, because those feelings are real. And if you know that at the end of the day, I will have time to attend to this, it really makes a difference.
Do you find that there is a general difference between the way we approach men who have experienced loss versus the way we approach women who have experienced loss?
I think so. I mean, I think, or because I actually think in general, we socialize boys and men to not express feelings of sadness and vulnerability even more than women. And for men, it can be okay to express anger. And again, this is a broad generalization, but it happens quite a bit that men are socialized where it's okay to express anger and not okay to express sadness and vulnerability, and women vice versa. And I do find that a lot of times, and again, I don't want to overgeneralize because sometimes this is flipped, but a lot of times men are so overwhelmed with their feelings that they will either isolate, or like if they've lost a spouse, they immediately put somebody else in that role because they can't bear to face the pain of that emptiness. So men who've lost a spouse tend to remarry very quickly, whereas women often will wait longer just because they are allowed to experience their pain and get support. I remember when I went to a support group, it was like a large group where I was learning about grief right after my husband died. And the woman who was leading the group called attention to this difference between men and women, because another aspect of this is men tend not to seek support because they're ashamed of their vulnerability and their feelings. Women will seek support. And the woman at this large group gathering of people who were grieving and learning about the grief process, the leader said, look around and notice who's here. There were about 80 women and 5 men.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think it's important for men to know that it's okay to seek support. That, in fact, that's one of the biggest things, is that intense emotions, whether it's grief or any other kind of intense emotion, is almost impossible to bear alone. That our brains are actually wired to be social, and we learn how to bear intense emotion in relationship. And so grief sometimes, whether it's due to divorce or death or a circumstance that takes something away from you, can often be the most intense emotional experience people have had in adulthood. And to get help, whether it's through a support group or a friend or a minister or a therapist, is normal. You need support to bear intense emotions like that. That's actually the reflex that we have, and it's normal to need that, whether you're a man or a woman.
So it's okay to be human regardless of your gender.
That's exactly right. Exactly.
Let's talk about some of the myths that are so often attached to the grieving process. Certainly one of them is if you're still grieving after 6 months or a year, there's something very wrong with you. What are some of the other?
Some of the others are the stages of grief model, where the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross stages of grief that got hijacked from Kubler-Ross wrote that about stages of grief for people who are dying, and people took that and applied that to people who are bereaved. And I think that that model became so popular because it gives the illusion that that grief is a programmatic thing that we can go through in a very specific way and check off some boxes, and once you accomplish that, then you're done. And it really sustains that illusion that we have control, that we can make grief tidy and neat. And the stages of grief model has been debunked over and over again. It's like, yes, there are many different phases of grief and different emotions that go with grief. That is accurate, but there's no predictable stage model in which these things unfold in a linear fashion, one after another, until an end point. Another aspect of that that is very popular in our culture is the finality of grief, that you get to a point where you achieve acceptance or letting go. And that can be actually counterproductive for people to believe, because it makes it terrifying to face your grief, especially if it's of a dear loved one or of a marriage that meant a lot to you or something like that. If you are expected to come to a point where you let go of all of that, where it's just gone and erased from your psyche, nobody wants that. That it can actually make people avoid their grief because they're frightened that if they do grieve, they're going to lose their inner relationship with this loved one. And a more accurate idea that really fits with what helps most people make it through a grief process is the idea of continuing bonds. That part of the grief process is actually, and part of what you're contemplating and running through your mind when you're attending to your grief and your pain, is how do I develop an internal ongoing relationship with this person who I loved? It's, you know, maybe you have rituals, ways of remembering this person on certain holidays, or habits of your own that you notice, emerged from being in relationship with this person, something about yourself that has changed in a way that you enjoy because of having spent time living with someone for some years, that kind of thing. So that myth of letting go, replacing that with the idea of how you develop continuing bonds.
I'm thinking back to a couple of years ago when I was in school, learning about all of this. And at that time, there was the sense that if someone developed rituals around the loss of someone or actually continued an ongoing relationship, that was maybe not so healthy. And then we had to take a look at whether or not there was a cultural support for actually engaging in ongoing relationships. So it's really interesting that in today's world, I don't know, do you think there is more of an acceptance that there is a... there are a broad range of cultural impacts on how people grieve and maintain connections with loved ones?
I do think it's very impacted by culture. And, as you're saying that, what I think is that in our mental health field, so much of the mental health education emerged from a medical model perspective, where we view people's struggles as illnesses that need to be cured. And that's something that I see in grief a lot with the mental health perspective in our culture. And I think that this medical model view of grief has permeated the entire culture, not just the mental health field, but where we look at a difficult situation like grief that is very painful as an illness that somebody needs to recover from. And if you look at grief like that, then certainly it would lead to an idea that having rituals or something that perpetuate an ongoing internal relationship might be unhealthy because it doesn't, quote, cure the grief, which cure means an end to something. And so for me, I like to take the psyche out of a medical model and put it more into more of a kind of a mentorship model where any kind of painful, difficult circumstances needs somebody to kind of mentor us through our experience and to discover our own path through, but with guidance. And 'cause another thing that's related to this having rituals to continue relationships or people struggling with grief is certainly sometimes people's grief processes become problematic for them. It's not just that grief takes a long time and is proceeding through a course that is actually leading to ongoing healing. Sometimes people get stuck and they become depressed or they become overwhelmed or they start ruminating and they can't let it go. And in our medical model, people tend to call that complicated grief or prolonged grief or disordered mourning or something like that, that pathologizes that. But what's really true is that when we experience intense emotions, it actually can light up all kinds of historic ways that we have not been helped to deal with intense emotions in our past. So if somebody's struggling with their grief in a way that is problematic for them, what's true is they are actually being presented with an opportunity to heal a historic wound that has probably affected their lives in other ways that are more minor up until now. And they just need help to heal that wound and do their grief, not to be told that there's something wrong with their grief.
Which is a very different way of looking at quote-unquote complicated grief.
Exactly. I really think complicated grief is simply grief that has also hooked into a historic difficulty of working with emotions, and it's an opportunity to heal the current situation and the way we were taught or traumatized around emotions in our earlier lives.
You believe that attaching such terms as resilience and recover are counterintuitive and actually disempowering when it comes to going through the grief process. Why is that?
Well, because to me, it's like if I need to recover from grief, that means it's a bad, that implies it's a bad thing that I need to cleanse from my system. I need to get rid of it, which to me implies it's something that I shouldn't be with, that it's negative, that it's something that needs to be fought like a disease. Whereas reality is that when we experience a loss, it's like a wound to our psyche. There's a gash in the center of our soul, and it shatters our self-organization, the things that we've believed to be true about our world. And so it's kind of like having open heart surgery and then going home from surgery to a house that has fallen down from an earthquake. And if you just try, if you were in that situation and somebody said, well, just get back to normal, just start functioning and live in this house as if it hasn't fallen down, you'd look at them like they're crazy. You have to have time to heal from surgery, and you have to rebuild a house that's fallen down. Grief, the grief process is healing from surgery and rebuilding a house. So if you say you shouldn't have to do that, you should get over that, it's kind of like saying just live in your falling down house and pretend like it hasn't fallen down and function as if you haven't had surgery.
So it's kind of cruel.
It is. And the other piece is, I think implied in resilience is resilience means to bounce back, to get back to normal. And I think I understand the idea that we want people to feel better and get back to being able to live a life where they're not in such deep pain. That's a reasonable desire. But I think to have a big loss, you're never going to get to go back to the way it was. The idea that you bounce back to the way it was is, one, impossible. You can't go back after a divorce, after a loss. You're never going to get to go back to the normal you had before. And you're missing an opportunity. When our self-organization comes apart in the way it does after a massive loss, if we have help to bear the painful feelings that are part of the healing process, it makes us grow. That's part of what we are wired for. Loss is inevitable for us as mortal creatures. We can't avoid it. That's part of being human. But part of being human is also that we are given this wiring that allows us to grow in these ways. When we come apart and people help us bear the healing process, we come back together in a way that's more deep and profound and compassionate and strong. And so to imply we should bounce back means we should skip over all that growth that is available to us if, instead of bouncing back, we slowly move forward.
Candace, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about ways to bounce back.
Okay.
But not bounce back.
Yeah.
Ways to grow back. Folks, yeah. This is Pamela Brewer. We'll be back in a moment. Candace, you said on more than one occasion the great value that you placed on your opportunity to work with a wonderful therapist as you were going through your grieving process. But for those who don't, for any number of reasons, have that opportunity, what do you recommend as one goes through the grieving process?
Mm-hmm. Great question. First of all, if you really need support, and it's hard to do it on your own, there are resources that don't cost money in most cities as far as for a post-divorce support group or bereavement support groups. So I really encourage people to seek out those kinds of support groups if they need them. But if even that is beyond something you don't want to do, or if it's beyond the capability of your time and resources, I really think, like I said before, like giving yourself at least some small amount of time on a regular basis to specifically attend to your healing, even if it's 5 minutes a day. And journaling is an excellent, excellent way of helping yourself heal. Because basically the more we can put our feelings into words, it brings it up out of that kind of blobby experience I was talking about earlier, where it just feels like a mishmash of feelings inside us. The mishmash always feels overwhelming, but if you can start to put words to what the different aspects of the feelings are, it can really make a difference and start to, even though you might still feel pain, the pain starts to move. It starts to shift. If you don't like journaling, I think body movement can be really important. Some people really resonate more with moving their bodies while they think, like walking, or if you can't even get out of the house because you have little kids, you know, walk up and down the stairs, do sit-ups, do something that you're moving, but turn your mind towards just contemplating what you're feeling. The other thing to remember is, no matter whether you're having help or whether you're doing this on your own, the thing that nobody talks about but I think is hugely important is that grief has a natural rhythm. In order to, the image that I was using earlier about how loss is like a wound and the self disorganization is like your house falling down, opposite actions are needed to heal each of those things. And in order to heal the wound, we need to pull inward and feel our feelings of sadness, of anger, of just contemplation of what that our new relationship inside is going to look like. That kind of healing really involves pulling in, holding on to ourselves, seeking support, all kinds of stuff that you would imagine, like if you did have like a flu. You know, rest, lie there looking at the ceiling, get somebody to help you make dinner, you know, feed yourself well, those kinds of recuperative things. In order to rebuild a life without your loved one, to reorganize yourself, you have to take action. You have to step out into the world and do things without your loved one, to do things as a single person when you were married before. You have to actually live in the world and take action, which requires courage and strength and activity. What is actually interesting is there is a natural movement back and forth between pulling in and going out. And if you know that's there, if you start to listen to your own rhythm, and follow times where you need to rest and times where you need to go out into the world and take action, healing starts to happen in a really natural way.
There are those folks around the person who's experienced a loss who will, yes, out of their own sense of loving the person, wanting them to heal, and maybe really mm-hmm. just not knowing what to say, will say things yes. like, you know, it's time for you to start dating again. Mm-hmm. You know, you really do need to get over it. He was such a mm-hmm. bad guy. She was just terrible. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to those kinds of people who are actually saying things that you find hurtful, but you know that they mm-hmm. mean the best for you when they mm-hmm. say these hurtful things?
Yes. You know, what I find is if we can, the more we can make, I call it making the implicit explicit, it really helps. If you can say, like you said it really well right then, if you can say, I really know you mean well. I know you're trying to help me, but I have to do this in my own way. I'm not ready to date, and it actually grates on me when you tell me I should date. So if you could find another way to help me, I would appreciate that. You know, if you can just really name that, that's what I mean by making it explicit. Just name, I know you're trying to help me, and this is what I actually need. I think that can generate less of a feeling of having been corrected, you know?
I know that you do training for therapists who are working in these areas. Is there something that you typically find surprises you as you approach your training work with therapists?
I think I am often surprised by two things. Specifically with grief, I'm surprised at how little knowledge there is conveyed in graduate schools about grief that's accurate. Grief is such an ubiquitous experience for everyone, and every therapist sooner or later is going to deal with a client who's grieving something. And most graduate schools kind of spend 5 minutes going over this stages of grief and talking about complicated grieving, and then they move on. So I'm always surprised at how little people know about grief. And the other thing that is surprising that I find is that how little is required of therapists in training to do their own therapeutic work. I think that we learn as therapists that we are fellow humans helping people in their struggles when we face our own struggles. I think it's easy for us to get in a position of thinking that we are the healthy ones who are going to fix the broken people when they come to us, when we haven't actually sat in the chair of the client to learn about our own inner worlds. And so I'm really surprised at how few graduate schools really require therapists to go in and do their own work.
And, you know, I think that if you approach your client as though they're broken, you're already mm-hmm. colluding with them in a way that's not useful for them.
I agree. In fact, the neuroscience that talks about that's discovered mirror neurons and how we respond non-verbally to each other has shown that our clients can read unconsciously, non-verbally, within 1/4 of a second, whether we are pathologizing them or whether we are looking at them with respect. And when a client walks into the room with a therapist who is looking at them through the lens of pathology and kind of judging them as sick, they will not reveal as much vulnerable information as when they walk into a room with somebody who's looking at them with kindness and respect and seeing them as a fellow human struggling. It's fascinating.
You mentioned neuroscience, and you talk about mm-hmm. emotion science. What mm-hmm. what does that teach us about the grief process?
The thing that that is two things. One is what I was saying earlier about how we learn to deal with emotions in relationship with another person. That is our brains are wired to be social, and we learn about relationships and we learn about emotions in relationship with another person. And so and when we have intense emotions that overwhelm us, the very thing we do need is another person who is not overwhelmed by our emotion to help us contain and manage that emotion. So that's the first thing. It's normal to need relationship to help ourselves heal from an intense emotional experience. The second thing that emotion science teaches is that when emotions don't get blocked because of our own fear of the emotion, or because we've been shamed for the emotion, or because we're afraid of it, when emotions don't get blocked, they have a natural movement. They move through us, and they actually lead to adaptive actions. The adaptive action, for example, that comes from the sadness of grief is that recuperative pulling inward that actually causes us to heal and rebuild our insides. The adaptive action of anger that's expressed in a healthy way is to take action on our own behalf, to move out into the world, to set boundaries, to say things like, the way you're talking to me, I know you intend it to be helpful, but it's actually hurting me. That comes from an adaptive movement of anger. So that's the other thing. That's the thing with emotion science, is that emotions themselves are adaptive and lead to adaptive actions if we have help to express them in ways that are healthy.
What would you say is the greatest takeaway that you would like those who are listening to our conversation today to have? There are one or two significant takeaways. Mm-hmm. What would you like for them to be?
I would like them to be grief responses are normal responses to loss and adversity, and your response will be unique to you. Two, it's normal to need help and support with intense emotions that go along with any kind of loss. Three, give yourself a little bit of time each day or each week to attend to your emotional experience when you're going through something difficult, and attend to your rhythms of pulling in and taking action, and you'll find that healing happens naturally.
When your husband passed away, your child was 11 months old. For those who have older children, how would you suggest they think about sharing the grief process with the child?
That's something that can actually be really helpful for if a parent can't, the more the parent can start to articulate what is going on for them in their grief process, the better. In that, like, it's okay to tell your kid, I'm feeling really sad today, so I'm having a hard time getting moving, so we're going to order pizza. That's just kind of like a good example of expressing what's going on for you and how you're going to take care of yourself. Being able to just put your feelings into words and describe them to your children in an age-appropriate way can help them. Kids see that you're upset, so if they can hear how you're talking about it and how you're taking care of yourself, it will normalize their experience of you. The other thing to remember as a parent is to tell your kids, I'm taking good care of myself. I'm still here for you. I'm having a hard time, but I'm doing X, Y, and Z to take care of myself so that I will still be here for you. That's helping the kids understand the parents' experience. For the parents to help the children, like to encourage the children to talk about their feelings, and to encourage the children to know that their own rhythms are normal. Children tend to move in and out of grief more fluidly than adults do. You know, they might have a moment of feeling extremely sad or upset, and then they're off playing, and they're not thinking about it. They're actually really quick to move in and out of it. So to really encourage the children to listen to their own inner rhythms of their emotions, and to make it safe for them to express their emotions, and to let them know that they might feel a lot of different things, including anger and sadness and jealousy of their friends who haven't lost their parent or something like that.
Candace, you have an ebook that I thought was really wonderful that I'd like for you to share your website with listeners.
Okay, thank you. Yes, my website is CandiceCounseling.com. That's C-A-N-D-Y-C-E, CandiceCounseling.com. And the grief ebook is available right there when you go to that website. And there's also a page of other grief resources on that website.
Terrific. Candace, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us today, for sharing your experience with us, your personal experiences, as well as your professional awareness as well. Candace Osford-Russell, a grief advocate and counselor. Again, thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you for having me. I'm really honored that you took the time to talk to me.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to myndtalk.org, or you can simply go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That is a confidential email address. Only I will see it. So again, that's pamela@myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, it's unacceptable. Take care.